Good morning. My name is Sarah Tu, and it's an honor to get to share with you all today. My family and I have been part of North Valley for about 3 years. I'm married to Dan, and we have 4 daughters. Maggie is 16, Lucy's 14, Grace is 9, and Ren is 7. And I'm much more comfortable singing into a microphone than speaking. But as my work colleagues in the room know, I do like slides, so I'll see some slides today. Please pray with me. Help us, Lord, to realize that our voyage of discovery in search of you consists not of seeking you in new lands, but in seeing you with new eyes. Amen. Dan and I lived and worked in college residence halls for 18 years at 4 different institutions. For 7 of those years, we lived in this building, a 6-person dorm of primarily first-year students. First-year move-in day in August was, to put it mildly, a circus, an ordeal, a whole thing. New students and their families paraded through the building, carrying loads of boxes and bags and lamps and mini-fridges and lots of Gatorade, constructing and deconstructing furniture and asking questions. One particular year on this move-in day, fire alarm went off. Okay, by now, I am a seasoned residence life professional. I snap into action and help usher people outside onto the lawn. With the help of our newly trained eager RA staff, we were all wearing matching shirts, and that helped. It was chaotic, but we could do this. However, partway through this madness, another loud sound emerges, a tornado siren. So now we have a fire alarm and a tornado siren happening simultaneously. Let me spell that out more clearly for you, since we're not in the Midwest. We need to evacuate everyone outside, fire alarm, and also usher everyone inside and to the basement, tornado warning. The basement that can definitely not hold all these students and families. Where do we go? The chaos multiplied. There were several panicked calls to public safety, and to be honest, it was all such a mess that it's hard to remember what exactly happened. Besides, thankfully, there was no real fire, and a tornado did not touch down near us. And now, Dan and I left. This is week 4 in our series on refuge. Leslie kicked us off and spoke about God's concern for refugees. Then the following week, Leslie shared about the importance of needing a safe harbor. Last week, Colin spoke on God as our refuge of transformation. If you missed any of these, they are all available on our website. The word refuge is most often used to refer to a place or to tell others to take refuge. The Erdman's Bible Dictionary says it is a shelter or relief from danger or anxiety, a high rock, a secure dwelling place, a place to flee to, a shelter. God is the ultimate refuge and source of strength during times of trouble. The term refuge implies a safe haven, a place of shelter and security where one can find protection from harm, difficulty. It suggests turning to God in times of fear, uncertainty, or when facing adversity. The concept of refuge in the Bible extends to both physical threats like storms or enemies and spiritual or emotional challenges like shame, loneliness, anxiety. God is seen as a refuge in all these situations, offering shelter, protection, and strength. Since the moment Leslie and Colin asked me to consider preaching, despite really wanting to say no, I somehow knew I needed to say yes. The yes has been to the journey of preparation. And the journey, as odd as this may sound, started long before I was asked. Because the more I have delved into God as refuge, the more I have found that throughout my entire life, there are scattered, assorted experiences and examples of God as refuge. But the very concept and reality of God as refuge is one that has taken hold of me from a really young age, even if I would not have named it that way at the time. and that when I was looking up lists of songs on the theme of God as refuge, some of which you heard this morning, and sang, it was as though I had typed in to the search bar hymns that have significant meaning to me, Sarah Taylor, personally. Apparently, this topic has long been close to my heart. This experience has reminded me of a poignant moment in the Disney film Tangled, the story of Rapunzel, which I highly recommend regardless of your age, by the way. Rapunzel has been living in a tower since she was a baby, you likely know this. Out the tower window every year on her birthday, she sees lights that she can't quite understand but is drawn to, and she desires to see them more closely. After an epic adventurous tower escape into the city, she experiences these lights and other symbolic connections much more closely, but ends up locked back in her tower. There's a quiet moment in her sad return to solitude when she's staring at the enormous wall, pictured here, kind of unfolded like an architectural and ceiling mural that she's been painting for years and years. She had a lot of time on her hands and she was multi-talented. Suddenly, the light connects everything in her painting. She sees exactly what was drawing her, but the truth is the entire picture. This resembles how I have felt with journeying in God as refuge, that it's not a new concept. It's always been the reality, and that each day I see more and more connections with God as refuge, God as shelter, God as strength. What is your mural? Where have you seen God as refuge in your life? In grad school, one of my final papers for a class was a spiritual autobiography. Through the process of writing out significant pieces in my own journey, I had a similar experience to Rapunzel of dot connecting. Wait a second, hold on. If I'm reviewing this right, it looks like, since my family broke apart when I was really young, that God set and established me in new families and communities in each and every season from that point on. Psalm 68, 5 through 6. Father to the fatherless, defender of widows, this is God whose dwelling is holy. God places the lonely in families. He sets the prisoners free and gives them joy. But he makes the rebellious live in a sun-scorched land. My colleague and friend Rebecca spent 5 years in Nairobi, Kenya, where she was a designer for Amani Yaju, a micro-enterprise for refugees. I asked Rebecca this week, what does it mean that God is our refuge? She said, God as refuge is perhaps caught up in the language of God as home. Home implies safety, stability, warmth. God as refuge insists that he is all the things that a shelter, a community, a robust home would entail. Not in a crate and barrel sort of way, but the most basic, mysterious, common elements of what it means to be home. Our scripture passage today is Exodus 14, 10 through 30. I'm going to read a retelling of the story from the Jesus storybook. There are a lot of pretty terrible children's Bibles out there, but this one has been a staple in raising our kids. Now you might be thinking, someone needs to tell Sarah that the children of Korah have been dismissed. I think that sometimes familiar stories can take new and restored meaning in our lives when we hear and see them told a different way. So as God's people, as God's children, let's enter into this story. To bring us up to speed, at this point, Moses and God's people had escaped out of Egypt. God had promised to bring them to a new home and provided a pillar of smoke for them to follow. But suddenly, Pharaoh and his army were right behind them. And that's where we meet this up. What were God's people going to do? In front of them was a big sea. It was so big, there was no way around it. But there was no way through it. It was too deep. They didn't have any boats, so they couldn't sail across. And they couldn't swim across because it was too far and they would drown. And they couldn't turn back because Pharaoh was chasing them. They could see the flashing swords now glinting in the baking sun and the dust clouds, and chariot after scary chariot surging towards them. So they did the only thing that was left to do. Panic.
We're going to die,
they shrieked. Don't be afraid, Moses said.
But there's nothing we can do,
they screamed. God knows. You can't do anything, Moses said. God will do it for you. Trust him and watch.
But there's no way out,
they cried. God will make a way, Moses said.
Another minute and it would have been over.
And then the strangest thing happened. And you know it's a big deal because you have to turn the book sideways at this point. God made the pillar of smoke move. It moved behind his people and hid them from the Egyptians. Then God sent a strong east wind to blow all night long. It blew on the water of the big sea. It blew it to the left and it blew it to the right until it blew it into two towering walls of water. And there, right through the middle of the sea, a muddy pathway opened up. And God's people walked across dry land. When the Egyptians tried to follow, the walls of water crashed back down on them and swallowed them up. God's people were safe. They danced and laughed and sang and thanked God. When there had been no way out, God had made a way. Many years later, once again, God was going to make a way where there was no way. From the beginning, God's children had been running from him and hiding. God knew his children could never be happy without him. They couldn't get back to him by themselves. They were lost. They didn't know the way out. But God knew the way, and one day he would show them. How is this story, the parting of the Red Sea, an act of refuge, a picture of God as refuge? The Israelites found a physical safety and spiritual protection from their oppressors. It symbolizes a crucial moment of faith and deliverance, emphasizing God's role as a faithful provider and a safe haven for those who trust in him. We know that this story is just one of the many in the mural of the Israelites, and that what they had just seen and experienced and learned would be quickly forgotten and replaced with doubt, fear, and anger. It's easy for me to think, oh, those Israelites, will they ever learn? And yet my journey of connecting my dots, God as refuge in my life, have revealed how quickly I too forget and panic and fear and complain. So fast forward several years later, in that same giant building, now this is the front, Maggie and Lucy are 4 and 2. By now we have lived through many, many, many fire alarms, 30 in our first year alone, and every time it is chaos. Hundreds of students evacuating out a lobby, often between 2 and 4 a.m. We never quite knew how long a given fire alarm would take to resolve. Thankfully, most were not actual fires. Dan was RD this time, and my job was to get through the crowd with crying toddlers in a double stroller on the long path towards our car, which was our refuge during these fire alarms. RAs would help part the sea of students for me to get through. I will always remember one particular alarm. Yet again, in the middle of the night, when we made our way to our Toyota Corolla, and Dan was able to come join us shortly after. So the 4 of us sat there, unbuckled and in close quarters, as we watched and waited for all to be resolved. Dan had recently given his notice on this job, and we did not know what was next. We knew what was behind, but not ahead. We knew when we needed to move out, because this job was tied to our living situation. And we were scared. We could not see a way forward. What I remember sitting in our car in the dark that night with the lights flashing all around from the firefighters as they went to check out yet another popcorn microwave for way too long type situation is that I felt and I knew and I understood so clearly that God had us, that whatever was ahead of us, that he was holding us, that he was and would continue to be our refuge. My friend Kate is a pastor in Pasadena, a professor at Fuller, and founded and directed the Institute for Collective Trauma and Growth, which she led for over 10 years. In that work, she led deployments and response efforts to over 30 disasters, including hurricanes, tornadoes, wildfires, and mass attacks. This week, I asked Kate what it means that God is our refuge. She said, God invites and welcomes our full range of emotions. God regularly asks humans about how they are doing in their circumstances. God deeply cares about our perspectives and is inviting us to process our experiences, particularly our most challenging and painful ones. We have lived in Newburgh for nearly 8 years total, but with a gap dividing those 8 years. For 3.5 years, we lived in Santa Barbara, California. In our first year there, I was pregnant with our fourth dog, Wren, who you might know, and we had our first experience with California wildfires. We lived in a residence hall down the road from Westmont College, and Dan had to help his residents evacuate before the end of the semester as the Thomas Fire moved closer to us. I will never forget the sight of fire up on that ridge above where we lived. The ash covering everything in the thick sky. A photographer friend of ours took this picture from one of my favorite places, the Bird Refuge, which was about a mile from our house, our home. In the midst of trying to figure out what we were going to do, my water broke. Remember, I was pregnant. We brought Wren home from the hospital and had to evacuate our home the very next day, 3 days after she was born. Our family of now six with newborn needed to leave quickly, and not only leave, but find somewhere to be for an undetermined amount of time, and not know whether we could come back to that home. Santa Barbara is narrowly sandwiched between the mountains and ocean, so it was north or south. We did not know where to go. We had no family nearby. We were brand new to California. A friend called. I have a sister, an hour and a half north of you. She said, you can come stay there. We did that. We stayed there for our first 2 nights with people we had never met before, but who provided a home, food, and shelter. These friends who called were Aaron and Jamie Johnson, who many of you may know from here in Newburgh. Other friends called. You can come stay in our house. You can have the whole house. We'll be gone for the holidays. This is right before Christmas. Not sure if you want to drive up this far, but please know, our house is yours. These friends, Russ and Steph St. Cyr. While we didn't drive up this far, we will always remember that offer of welcome and refuge. Other friends called. My parents live 5 hours north of me. I find that I'm actually trying to do the voices of these friends without realizing it. My parents live 5 hours north of you. They have plenty of space, and they said you can stay as long as you want. So after our first 2 nights, we drove further north and stayed at Gordon and Serena Burns' house, the parents of Grant Burns. Grant and Katie are former North Valley folks and dear, dear friends of ours. Our friendship was actually forged in that giant, crazy dorm where we worked together. We went there. We drove. We arrived at Grant's parents' home and did not know how long we would need to be there. Checking the news in a really surreal and frantic sort of way to see, have things burned down? What is the fire doing? What is the wind like? How does this work? And all with the question of, can we and when can we go home? But meanwhile, Gordon and Serena, who actually we came to know as Bop Bop and Nai Nai, were our hosts. What a refuge it was for us. In the midst of the fear and the chaos and the newbornness and recovery, here were these grandparents who not only welcomed us, but somehow gave our three big girls attention and love and free reign of their living room, in which an epic My Little Pony dramatic production took place. The town we were in, Santa Rosa, had experienced a devastating wildfire the year prior. We had multiple appointments for little Wren and for me, and at each one were met with such knowing compassion about our displacement, about the unspeakable devastation of wildfire. It was 2 weeks before we were able to head back to our apartment in Santa Barbara. How did God take something so frightening, so unsettling, so chaotic, and provide such a refuge, a place for waiting and healing?
He had us and he held us. And how, now, today, nearly 8 years later, can I stand here and share this with you, when for so long, it was just too painful to remember, to see pictures and to discuss. In preparing, I found the North Valley has indeed become to me a refuge, a safe place to share this dramatic story. Our friend Rachel has worked for World Relief for the last 7 years. World Relief is a global Christian humanitarian organization whose mission is to boldly engage the world's greatest crises in partnership with the church. This week I asked Rachel her thoughts on what does it mean that God is our refuge. She said, "In my time spent with refugees, they have taught me what it means that God is our refuge in every circumstance. The safety of his arms transcends our lowest lows and our highest highs, a safety that is far too often taken for granted. In particular, one woman I met who was forced to flee her country because of her faith challenged me once on whether I really knew what it meant to find my refuge in God. She said that she never once doubted God's protection of her, even in the scariest of moments. When a refugee arrives to safety, the relief they feel being able to put their guard down is immense, like we can feel, resting in the palm of God's hand. But they would be the first to tell you that the same God that journeyed with them through their lost, harrowing days is the God who goes with them now. They know that the refuge of God is unchanging." The story of the prodigal son has long been one that is close to my heart. While it might not be known this way, I connect it to God as refuge. One of my favorite books is Return of the Prodigal Son by Henri Nouwen. We have a replica of the famous Rembrandt painting hanging in our living room. The father's hands, his arms, his home, represent a place of refuge, forgiveness, and restoration for the younger son and for the older son. It's been there all along. It's right there, waiting for you. One of my favorite books, an attempted yearly reread, is Prayer in the Night by Anglican priest Tish Harrison Warren. I'd like to read a condensed section. It's a bit long. We'll take it. Tish writes, "I have a friend who's a textile artist. Among other things, she sews nautical flags, because besides the fact that they're gorgeous, there's an accidental poetry to them. According to Merit Tears, there are 40 flags in a complete set of international maritime signal flags, one for each letter of the English alphabet, one for each number, and 4 flags called substitutes, which perform special operations. Raised by themselves or in different combinations, the flags mean different things. White with a blue cross, followed by a flag divided into 4 colored triangles, means what is the wind doing? Yellow and red triangles mean man overboard. There are combinations for races and to warn about gales." Tierce writes, "I wish we could fly such flags, we humans, ships unto ourselves, to communicate our states of balm or damage, our current headings, our desires and lacks. Maybe my friend's radio has gone out, but at least he could fly his small 'I am suffering' on this sunny day flag, and I could raise my 'I will take a walk with you and listen' flag. We could see each other, understand and act without having to say all the words." Now picture yourself in a boat, lost and afraid, adrift as the sun sets, with no way to contact anyone except for the flag you've been given this very moment. For this very moment. You don't know what else to do, so you raise the flag, bright white with a red X. And you see a ship, distant but drawing nearer. It hoists flags in response, a bright red diamond on a white field, followed by another made of 2 triangles, yellow and red, and then lastly, a white trapezoid marked with a red circle. This is the flag combination that my friend sewed to hang on her bedroom wall. It means, "I will keep close to you during the night." The hope God offers is this: he will keep close to us, even in darkness, in doubt, in fear, and in vulnerability. He does not promise to keep bad things from happening. Does not promise that night will not come. or that it will not be terrifying, or that we will immediately be tugged ashore. He promises that we will not be left alone. He will keep watch with us in the night. Now we're going to move into a time of open worship. This is a time for expectant waiting, listening for guidance and messages that may come from within. If any of you feel moved to speak out of the silence, please raise your hands and a mic will be brought to you. I've provided a few questions here. Go to the next slide. Feel free to use or not use. Thank you.